Sunday Night with John Cleary.
Father Brian Gore. Do you remember the name? Some of you will. Brian Gore first rose to prominence in Australia when, as a young Catholic priest, he found himself in a head-on confrontation with a Marcos dictatorship in the Philippines. Charged with murder in the Philippines, many felt that it was a political setup, as it proved to be. And Brian Gore's sojourn in the Philippines proved to be perhaps one of the elements that eventually led to the collapse of the Marcos dictatorship, that along with a number of other things. Brian Gore has gone on to a career with the Columbans in Australia. He was head of the Columban Order in Australia for some years and is now the provincial of the Columbans in the Philippines and on a return visit to Australia. Brian Gore, welcome to Sunday Night.
Good, thank you, John.
Brian, just remind us of those days. It's history slips away from us so quickly. Those days in the Philippines when all of a sudden from being a priest concerned with justice for his local folk, you found yourself in the centre of a national murder scandal.
Yes, those were heady times. I was at that time, I was about 40. I'd been in the Philippines about 15 years, and we knew that... As the dictatorship grew and became stronger, that we would eventually end up in some sort of a clash, because the kind of work we were doing among the peasant farmers and the workers on the sugar plantations would bring us into conflict with the powers to be. We were organizing them, helping to stand up for their rights, get better wages, all those sort of things. And, of course, that wasn't well looked upon by the powers, and especially the plantation owners. And as one plantation owner said to me, you know, Father, this was a very peaceful town until you came, and which I felt was one of the best accolades that I had received, that the people said, yes, Father, it was very peaceful, just like the cemetery. Nothing moved, nothing spoke, nothing happened. So the peace that I was sort of what I thought what the gospel brought was a different peace than what the planters wanted. So times were, you know, I mean, we expected something to happen, but as it unfolded, it was just a charade and the drama, and it just, they made more ones, one always making mistakes, and we just capitalized on their mistakes, and it drew out, as Bob Worth, who was an ABC reporter who covered the case, said, God, he says, Gore, you're into it, you'll be a three-day wonder, and but the 3 days developed into about 14 months, and you know, and we were able to capitalize on that, and was a way of bringing the situation of the Philippines to the Australian people.
You can talk about it with some comfort and distance now, but at the time, there must have been an extraordinary amount of stress felt. You had been elevated from a dispute with a local planter to all of a sudden this became a cause célèbre and a demonstration of the corruption of the entire Marcos system, and you must have felt at some point that these people could deliver. I mean, they had been, I mean, hit squads were not unknown in the Philippines.
Yeah, well, I suppose we were on a bit of a high because we had the support of the people, which was great. The only ones against us were the military and the small planter elite. Now, while it was possible for them to do something, there's a couple of things that was against that. There's a very strong belief in the Philippines, if you kill a priest, you're in real trouble with them, with the boss upstairs. You know, so there's a very lot of superstition around killing a priest. And even people who would be very much against us, and the mayor whom we were eventually accused of killing, he had said to some of the planters, he wasn't a regular church guy himself, and say, whatever you do, he said, don't you ever touch the priest. And we encouraged that kind of a belief that that killing the priest was not a very good thing to do, you know. So that gravitated against us. I mean, we were much better off than the ordinary people. I mean, it was the ordinary people who were the ones whose lives were more in danger. And, of course, once the media got onto it, we became, as you say, a bit of a cause célèbre. And that gave us a lot of protection. And I suppose that's what the media did at that time, both the print media and the television and radio. I was on every Sunday night to a radio station in Perth, you know, giving a blow-by-blow account what happened during the week. That helped us to keep us safe, I suppose.
You can look back on it now, as I've said, with some degree of comfort. What do you think, on reflection, it achieved? What did that whole case achieve in terms of that long-term exposure of the Marcos regime and what it meant? I'm thinking in terms of both the politics of the situation and the position of the church and the way the church was viewed.
I think, well, it was very good for certainly for the for Australia. I think that it was a bit of it was the, Australia and the Philippines. There wasn't a very you know, a strong relationship, and I think our case brought the Philippines onto the map a little bit more into the Australian people, and the case, because it was such a, you know, multiple murder is not. You know, it's a fairly serious thing, and citing to rebellion, illegal possession of explosive ammunition. I mean, those three charges were all capital offences, and yet people say, well, my goodness, what in the hell was he up to? I mean, and of course some people would say, well, there's smoke, there's fire, he must have been up to no good. Otherwise,
yes, because
why?
even here in Australia at the time, there was still the remnants of the religious right in the old sort of National Civic Council and those groups. So there was some concern in Australia that you had been sort of dabbling where you shouldn't have.
Yes, and of course within the church at that time, you know, like the church and revolutionary situations, there's no sort of blueprint in the Catholic teaching of how you deal in a revolutionary situation. And while we had opted for the what we would call active nonviolence, we were very active and we were very, in some cases, very confrontative against the system. Whereas a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, it's not our job to get involved in politics, so back off. So there was, I suppose one of the good things was it helped to bring that debate of, you know, where should we as church people be in a situation where people are struggling for, you know, for basic human rights and basic decency and a life and a livelihood. We do have a role to play. And it's not just sitting by and allowing the dictator to do what he likes. It's not joining the rebels in the mountains, as some priests did. And, you know, and I have no beef with that. But many of us said, no, our job is to work with the people and help to bring about a transformation, a social transformation without the power of the gun. The Marcos regime used the gun and the rebels used the gun. And we saw that there was no future, long-term future in that.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest is Father Brian Gore, Columban missionary priest, currently provincial of, that's head of the Columban Order in the Philippines, a country to which he has dedicated much of his life and indeed which at one point could have cost him his life. Brian Gore, let's talk about the impact of those events on the church. It's almost an age away now. We've had the regime in the church of Pope John Paul II. We're now into Benedict XVI. The early days of John Paul's pontificate seem to be coloured by priests popping up all over the world, getting themselves in politics, not only in the Philippines, but in Melanesia, then in Latin America. Mm. And it was a very difficult period for the church. Do you think the church handled that well?
John Paul II had a very strong sense of the social justice issues. But I think sometimes his background of being Polish and dealing with the Polish government, the communist government at the time, may have sort of put some limits on his broader thinking. You know, like in the Philippines, if you you're always accused of being communist if you were different from the government, which wasn't a communist government. It was if you want to call it a capitalist government. If you were again the capitalist government, it sort of put you in the camp that you were a communist. So it kind of muddied the waters. Usually the church was like the Columbans, we started off in China. We were thrown out by the communists in China. And yet here in the Philippines and in Latin America, because we were opposing the dictatorship, which was basically supported by all the so-called, you know, democratic governments of the world, you were viewed as in the light of being, you know, left or way over the left, and that made it much harder. You had to kind of prove yourself, whereas you could be, as they were in many countries, you could be supporting a dictatorship and not be questioned. But if you were questioning the dictatorship, you were being questioned or being suspect.
The other part of that is the way in which you approached your job. You used a model of the base Christian community of working with people at the grassroots level, which many people tied to the extremes of liberation theology. And so there was an intense debate inside the church. Has the church come to terms with that debate now?
I not really. I think the debate has broadened out now from being what we would call liberation theology into a more holistic of, you know, including the environment. I mean, it's not just social justice, it's the life of the planet now that we're also involved in.
And another Columban passionate issue, one of your colleagues, Sean McDonough, has been a guest on this program on occasion.
Yeah, the whole issue of you can't at this stage, you know, like 20, 30 years ago, the issue of the environment wasn't so startling, but it is today. So you cannot talk about religion, you cannot talk about social justice if we're not talking about the whole, not just the relationship between humans, but with the whole planet, with the destruction of the planet, which is the very base in which we're living, and the poverty of the of many of the people is going to be worse if we destroy the planet.
The base Christian community model was seen in terms of restoring economic justice. That model works for environmental justice as well.
It can, yes. And in fact, in the parts of the Philippines, it's just a matter of broadening out the struggle, if you like, against injustice is broadened out now into a thing which touches on the environment in which we're living, and it's just so realistic now. Like the farmers, getting social justice is one thing, and not being beaten up by the military or being thrown off your land. But even without that, there's still the effect of climate, the effect of genetically engineered crops, the effect of fertilizers and pesticides is making their lives much more miserable and it is killing them. So, we are concerned about that. So I suppose in the base communities, we're concerned about the lives of the people, and all those issues are part of their daily life and struggle.
Do the base communities work as a sacramental fellowship as well? That is, are they, in some ways, not only are they effective tools for bringing about justice, but are they effective tools for what one would loosely call evangelism?
Yes, well, I suppose for us, the basic Christian communities, and I think this is where my criticism today would be, that in places like the Philippines, we have the basic ecclesial communities, which is a different title. And the basic ecclesial communities seem to be more interested in just church stuff, whereas the basic Christian communities was a much broader into the social issues, the question of land, the question of wages. The basic ecclesial communities have moved away from that.
And that's a deliberate move on the part of the church?
Well, I think what happened certainly in the Philippines was with the 1986, 1987, even when Cory Aquino took over in the Philippines, the church under the what we would call this vigilante groups were introduced in 1986, just after Marcos was gone and Cory Aquino came in. In 1986, 1987, there was a tremendous influx into the Philippines of fundamentalist Christian groups. And with that, the military were having these vigilante groups, and they sprung up all around the Philippines, sponsored by the military, but at arm's length, so they didn't have to take responsibility. And the thing was, anyone who was progressive or who was anti-government was obviously a communist and therefore could be killed. I mean, that was very... And, of course, during 1986 and 1987, there were tremendous atrocities done by these groups. Priests were killed, church leaders were killed. And I think what happened was the church generally backed off and said, this is too hot. So about 1988, 89, they come up with the title of Basic Ecclesial Communities.
Did you ever feel abandoned by the church during that period?
I said to one of the bishops at the time, I said, this looks like a backward step. He said to me, well, actually, the BECs are really a stepping stone to back to the BCCs. Mm. But in fact, we haven't made that step. And I think what's happening in the Philippines today is many of the very, more vibrant church groups are very much into, church affairs.
They're internally focused.
Internally focused, rather than being interested in, as we were in those, the issues of the people were water, land, just wages. Those things don't seem to be as important in a lot of these groups. And I think the church got a, throughout the country, our case was one example, but around that time, 85, 86, there were a lot of attacks on church personnel, including priests and sisters, and then especially leaders were killed. So it became very, very hot. And I think there was a kind of an agreement to sort of back off and do something a little bit safer. So I think there was – in 94, though, the Church in the Philippines came out and said that we are the Church of the Poor. But I don't think that has been translated in reality into a lot of the action. Now, many of the bishops are involved in especially the anti-mining. The mining that's going on in the Philippines is very destructive. The bishops have been very strong on that. On the extrajudicial killings, there's been – during the reign of Mrs. Arroyo, there's been something like 800 union – peasant leaders, journalists, killed or executed by liquidation squads. And, you know, this is, some would say we're almost like martial law.
It's still a rough place to be.
Well, if you're anybody who's interested in bringing about some real substantial change, yes, it is. You know, it's more dangerous than – it's the second most dangerous place for journalists. Radio people, commentators have been shot because they're out against the corruption of the local politicians and, you know, issues and things like that. Then it's the second most dangerous part in the world.
I'll remember that, Brian.
You remember that, yes. If you come up there, just keep your mouth shut. But, you know, the people that the country needs are being eliminated. You know, vibrant people, whether they be union people, peasant leaders, women and men, journalists, people, you know, who are doing a little bit of critical analysis of the situation. It's a dangerous – and there is an election coming up. And recently in Manila, the military were out in the squatter areas of Manila campaigning against what they call, you know, the so-called – there are a few what they call minor parties who are becoming more popular, and they're regarded as left-wing parties. And they do range from, you know, extreme left to, you know, right over to almost to right. And the military are out campaigning against them, so and threatening people.
Yes. It seems almost one of those, for some of us, you look at it and you say, do some things ever have the capacity to change? You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest is Father Brian Gore, Columban priest, provincial of the Columban Order in the Philippines, a place which he has long association with. Brian, it seems that your life in the Philippines is condemned to be the cliched role of the turbulent priest, given that civil society has not improved over those years. But let's take you back into some of your formative experiences. As a young lad growing up in Perth, were you always a bit against the government, prepared to stand up and be counted, or did you find yourself thrust unexpectedly into that role?
Yes, it's strange. No, I wasn't. Even as a young seminarian, as somebody in the seminary, I was very non-political in many ways. I wasn't. The Vietnam War was going on when I was in the seminary, and it just didn't seem to even impinge on me, you know. I'd hear about it from other people. We were locked up away in the forests of Tarahumara at that stage, and on the national park there, and separated from the world. We're supposed to be going out and serving later on, and being formed. And when I got off, I suppose when I got off the boat in Manila, that was a real eye-opener, and I was literally thrust in off the deep end. My family wasn't my dad, oh, yeah, they would have been, dad would probably, he was a barber. And, of course, you know, barbers know everything, and they talk about all sorts of issues. But we didn't really discuss a lot of things at home. And I suppose at school, you know, growing up in the 50s was not, I mean, as young Catholics, we were interested, and I think our formation was that we were going to make it in this Australia that we had been barred from many years. You know, as Catholics, it was very hard to get. I remember doing exams in school, and we were told never in the public exams ever even give the indication that you were a Catholic, because you might be, you know, marked down.
Yes, well, the Masons might find out.
Yeah, or somebody else, some of those Protestants that we didn't like, you know. We used to have all these little ditties, proddy dogs, stink like frogs, you know. And then they used to say to us who were down the street, you know, was it CBC, Cry Babies College, you know, the Christian Brothers College and things like that. So that were terrible times when you think back on all that.
It all seems so long ago and far away. What gave you the sense that you were destined or called to the priesthood?
I suppose as a young lad, I was very impressed, I suppose, by the stories of the missionaries. And, you know, I think that was a very, sense of adventure, sense of, you know, going, doing something different. But I really didn't know what I was letting myself, even when I went through the seminary.
What do you think it was that sort of turned the key for you? Was it a priest you encountered? Was it something you read? Was it the sort of general cultural environment? Was there a moment when you thought, actually?
Yeah, I couldn't. I think it's things I read. The Columbans used to put out their propaganda magazine, which we still do, but we're not a trend. And then that, I think that sort of fed my mind a little bit onto, you know, a bit of adventure and certainly a little bit of a challenge. I'm a sort of person who likes a challenge. And as the fellows will say to you, that whatever you do, don't ever challenge Gore, because, you know, you're in for a rough ride. But if I am challenged, so I'm a person who likes a challenge. And I suppose that's what's got me thinking about, well, this priesthood looks all right, you know, the missionary especially. I had didn't want to be a priest here in Australia. And I thought, no, that's too boring. I want something that's going to be a little bit more adventure. And if I had known then what happened later on, I probably would have decided to stay in Australia. But it's good that we don't know these things. But I think it's my own personality. And having gone to the Philippines and then sort of seen the situation, you know, it was just crying out for somebody just to say, well, you know, hey, something's rotten in the state of Denmark. And, of course, when martial law was declared in 72, I arrived there in 70, you had to get involved. I mean,
what gave you the political equipment? That is, I mean, you said you grew up in essentially a suburban 50s where the big problems were between the sort of exclusive communities of Catholic versus Protestant. You grew up in a church environment. You become a priest at a time when essentially you're apolitical. The Vietnam War passes you by. What caused you, when you hit the Philippines, to think that, hang on, my priesthood is related to what's going on with these people?
Well, my first reaction was a reaction to what was going on. At that time, the 69-70s was pre-martial law, and there was a lot of upheavals among students, among, you know, organizations of farmers. Things were in a bit of a turmoil. That's why martial law was eventually declared in 72. So in those first couple of years, I really struggled with that because I wasn't prepared for it. I mean, there was no lessons in the theology on how to deal in a revolutionary situation or, you know. My first reaction was, you know, these people are overacting, you know, something's wrong. But eventually when I started to sort of, once I learnt the language and started talking with the people and then finding out what the poor people were experiencing, that's what converted me.
Inbuilt sense of the fair go kicked in.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's something, you know, I come from a very ordinary, you know, family background, Catholic family background, working class people. Mum used to work, Dad worked, both my parents worked, and we were born, there's only two of us boys, and you know, we didn't have a lot of luxuries or extras. We had enough to survive on and get a good education. And I think that sort of, when I got to the Philippines and Negros were the island I went to, have these plantations and sugar plantations. And it's really a model of feudalism. And I had things you read in a book, but you could actually see it with your eyes. And in fact, one day when I asked a man what his name was, he said to me, his answer basically was, I am the person who belongs to that person over there, to the plantation owner.
It's an answer you would get out of medieval Europe.
Yes, it was really, that shocked me. And I said to him, but you've been baptized. Yes, Father, what's your name? Jose. Okay, your name is Jose. And he looked at me with much, say, well, you know, where are you coming from? But, you know, that sense of no worth, that sense of being nobody and being a chattel, you know, I belong to. They were the words he used in the language. I belong to that person. And from the womb to the tomb, a lot of these people actually were totally dependent on the plantations. And, of course, that was a new experience for me. Then the poor people in the mountain areas who may not be on the plantations, but, you know, one day, one eat, you know, people saying, Padre, you know, we are, during certain times of the year, we only eat once a day. And then I thought, well, you know, why are the people so poor? This is a very rich island where, you know, sugar, the plantation, and then the plantation owner will come in and wants you to bless the new Mercedes-Benz. And you say, well, you know, God's going to wither my hand if I, you know, wither this. You know, I mean, this is what confronted me. And the dead children, that's what really got me. In my very early years, every day coming down as a good priest, my job was to bury the dead. But I had all these little coffins lined up in the church. And I started asking the question, why are the children dying? And they said, Padre, it's God's will. So this was a real confrontation for me as a priest. It's God's will that these children are dying. So Maria, Jose, and all these little two-year-old, three-year-old, and I said, well, what did they die from? And they say, well, you know, oh, it's God's will. Yes, okay, it's God's will. But what disease did they have? Oh, diarrhea, chicken pox, you know, simple diseases. And I said, well, why didn't you buy medicine? And they said, well, Padre, you know, we don't even get enough. The wages of my husband are not even enough to feed us. Hmm. And the owner is not paying for the Medicare, you know, that they're supposed to get. So then I said, well, the reason why Maria or Jose died was because the plantation owner was paying unjust wages. And because then the penny started to drop for the people. So for so long, they had accepted their lot in life. And this is what, you know, I suppose the church, by its silence and just accepting the system, went along with it. And many of us, it wasn't just myself, other Columbans, other Filipino priests were starting to say, you know, this is wrong. And of course, I suppose what we did was, it was a religious question. Is it or is it not God's will that people are poor? And of course, the traditional thing that were toted out, the poor you'll have with you always. And, you know, it's God's will. And we said, no, it ain't. And if it isn't God's will, then it can be changed. So that for the people, that was good news. The gospel was good news for the poor, but bad news for the rich.
Well, let's take you back to those formative days, even before that, and this was a time of change indeed. You selected Rock Around the Clock as a song you'd like to play. Why is that?
Well, I selected that because as I go back, when I was a teenager, I was still probably in short pants then, when Bill Haley and the Comets came out. And I remember Elvis's first one was Heartbreak Hotel, you know. These are sort of things that stay in your mind. And
they marked a certain change in the way we view the world, didn't they?
Yes, it did. And I was still, you know, my early teens. And I remember my first pair of blue suede shoes. I had a pair of blue suede shoes. I had pink socks and these lime green and these pink socks and flecky pants, you know, pants with the flecks through them. I thought I was the bee's knees.
Tell me, and you had a square back haircut.
Yeah, square back hair, and I pushed my hair back. That's when I started putting my hair back, you know, in the pushback. We used to call it pushback, I think they call it that, which, you know, because my dad was a barber and we always had parts that you could, you know, drive a car down, you know. And we were well known in the church as, you know, the barber's kids, you know, my brother and myself, because our hair was always...
It did really mark a change. I mean, we talk about Rock Around the Clock, it's a bit amusing, but it did really mark a change. It was a sense in which if music can be democratised and become part of, you know, three chords and guitar and you're away, then in some way we can take possession of everything else.
Yeah, it certainly was a break, you know, and that's why I chose that one. I thought, Bill Haley and the Comets, they started a revolution in some sense in music, didn't they, you know? And, of course, the Beatles came around the same time, a little bit after, but I think my first memory was the old Rock Around the Clock, and we had those records, we used to play them and on our little gramophone, you know?
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
Rock Around the Clock, a selection of our guest, Father Brian Gore. Father Brian Gore, let's now talk about today. What led you to take on the responsibility of provincial of the Columbans, firstly in Australia and then a decision to go to the Philippines? And what is the role of leadership in the church today?
Well, the decision is made by others. We have a semi-democratic system where people vote, and the first we have a vote, and then you get a panel of people to get the job, and then the membership vote on the panel. And if you could be in the top first or the second, then you might get the job. So it's really the kind of the looking at what the members want. And I was in the Philippines when I was asked to come back and be the provincial in Australia. And after 10 years in Australia, I decided it was time to go back to the Philippines.
There are huge issues facing the priesthood.
Yes, yeah. Well, there's the whole... Well, I mean, when I went to the Philippines in 1969, we were 254 Columbans and we were all young, probably the average age about 35. We were a vibrant, we were the biggest group in the Philippines. We had 160 plus parishes. We ran about 140 schools. I mean, we were a very vibrant group. Today, we are down to 55. The average age is 68, and I'm 63, so I'm just under average age. We have a few Filipinos who have joined us. We have an aging group, and the work we did previously for those 50 years from the 50 to 2000 was very much a parish-based ministry. But now those parishes have been taken over by Filipino priests, and that was our job, to come in, build up the local church, and then kind of move on. But I think we're a bit too old to move on now. So what we're saying, well, what do we do now? What is our role as Columban missionaries? Very few of us. We have some lay missionaries from Fiji and Korea working with us in the Philippines, and we've got Filipinos working in Peru and Ireland and other places. We're down to a very small number, so that's a very significant thing. So we're saying, well, you know, what is our contribution? And I think it's changed. We will no longer be involved in parishes, maybe one or two parishes in the Philippines, and formerly 160. We're not involved in schools as such. But I think we do have a role to play in making the local church that has now been taken over by Filipinos to be, you know, concerned about global issues and, you know, issues like global warming. Sean McDonough came to Manila a year ago at the invitation of the Archbishop, and they had he gave a retreat to all the priests in Manila. And now Sean is coming back again this year, and the Archdiocese of Manila under the Cardinal, they're going to set up eco ministries in each parish on global warming. Of course, Manila is only about 6 inches above sea level. So there's a fairly, self-interest in saying, well, hey, this is an issue that really concerns the people. And the poor people live in the more, lower areas. If you're rich, you can go a bit higher ground. So these are issues that I think we as missionaries, because of our global connections and our experience, we're able to sort of surface these and do something and encourage the local church to take on these issues: global warming, human trafficking, issues like genetically engineered foods, which is being pushed into the Philippines by the big multinational corporations. These are issues that we the missionary, we tend to think more globally in some ways.
This is one of the advantages, of course, and I think Sean McDonough was concerned about this too, that it's one of the advantages that the Catholic Church almost uniquely as a global institution has. That is, you're at once one with the people at the local level, yet you can take a global perspective. You can reach across the globe to colleagues in the order or even outside the order bring a global perspective and actually take the local global or bring the global down to the local.
We call it glocal now. Glocal. That's the
glocalism.
Glocalism, yeah.
Do you see your role as a provincial as being one of the sort of critical positions in that process of bottom-up or top-down?
Well, I think in many ways, certainly like in the Philippines, as foreigners, most of us are still foreigners, we tend to be a little bit more, when we're not on the front line anymore like we used to be. Because if you're in a parish, you're on a front line, you're there with the people. Now we're in a more supportive role, and I think in a critical role in bringing these issues up. And I think there are priests all around the world, you know, in Africa, Latin America, some of them Columbans, some of them not Columbans, but we are connected, and we're trying together. Like recently, a year or so ago, in the Vatican, there was that conference on genetically engineered foods, and the GE companies, with the help of the U.S. Embassy in the Vatican, were trying to get the church to endorse the genetically engineered stuff. Well, we had a great campaign all around the world pushing onto the Vatican saying, hey, listen, you know, listen to the people in the poor countries on this issue. It's not just, we're not going to feed the world because we've got genetically engineered crops, because it's not it's a question of distribution and social justice, why people are not got food. I mean, as Sean would say, like Brazil is producing, exporting huge amounts of food to the rest of the world, yet 40 million Brazilians go to bed hungry every night.
Yes, it's a red herring argument in a sense, isn't it? The genetically engineering argument isn't an argument simply about what these things may do to us biologically. The real argument is one about economic control.
It's control of the food crops, the staple food crops, and once you control that, you control the everything. Yeah. And in the Philippines, what they will do is, because they can't collect their royalties, what they do is they're introducing a new, and they've been pushed back a bit, but they're still trying to push the terminator gene, which means that these crops do not reproduce. Therefore, you have to buy every year new seed from the companies, and that's the way they can get their royalties. Now, that for us is just diabolical, that seeds which are meant to be life-giving and shared and used by farmers who've done it for generations are now no longer available to them, and they've got to buy these questionable seeds at a high price.
And it's a pretty profound theological question, because you're talking about patenting the very stuff of life. That is patenting God, in a sense, patenting God's handiwork.
Yes, and I think this is where the missionaries, what we see, these issues, say, like global warming and genetic engineering, human trafficking, the whole immigration of people, all these things are issues which, at the heart of the Christian gospel, because it's about people and it's about their lives and what's happening to them and the destruction, the environment, all these things. But in many cases, the local churches are very tied up with just the mundane day-to-day running of things, doing the baptisms, the marriages, the funerals, the problems, and this is great stuff and it has to be done. But I think what we're freer...
It's a beginning rather than an end in itself. Becomes a platform for something else. The life of the community, the church as a community, really needs to be a platform.
Yeah, and if we don't address these issues, we're going to be in, more and more trouble down the line. So we're saying these are global issues that weren't there, 50 years ago. When the Columbans went to China in 19, there were certainly problems then, but it's a totally different world. And therefore, as missionaries, we have to adjust ourselves to the demands and what we're able to do. And as a small group now, not as a big group, globally. But we work together with other groups. We work with non-government organizations. We'll work with any group that has these same goals of quality of life, the quality of the planet. So we work on global warming, on genetically engineered, with farmers groups and all these. So, we think that the moral dimension of these issues needs to be surfaced. And we think that, that's our job as priests, as church people, to say that, yes, this is not just a political or an environmental or a social question. It's also a very moral question.
What for you, finally, Brian Gore, how would you like to see yourself in the last years of your active priesthood? What for you? And I want to move away from that broader political thing now, just to talk about you personally. What gives you the greatest sense of satisfaction, and where do you see yourself as finally saying, I've done my best, and here's where I'll put it down?
Well, I think what I see my role now is in invigorating other people, younger people, and others to take up the cudgels. I say that to the young Filipino priests, it's time you fellows start taking over and sort of leaving room for them to develop. And in my own way, I suppose it's very hard, having been at this kind of a level of involvement, to sort of be not involved. I think I'll, whether I come back to Australia after a number of years or I have a lot of very close friends. I've got people, the lay workers who are in jail with me, all their kids are growing up. They call me granddad. I've known them, and now I'm great granddad because they're having their kids. So there's a very strong family connection with a number of people. And that's kind of a very... As somebody who's not had my own family, and as my family also, my parents, my mother is still alive, but my father's dead. Once your own family has become so small, then it gives you a new lease of life. I said to my mother a few years ago, give me some of my inheritance now, because I let's get these kids educated, get them some the children of the people who were in jail with me. And so that's something that's very strong for me as a personal thing, and I would always keep that relationship up as they're getting older and their kids are growing. So that's family for me too. That's my second family. Even as the Columban family dwindles, I've still got a broader family out there. So I could see myself maybe retiring, but I think, as the old bishop used to say to me, there's no retirement in the spiritual life, young man, he'd say. And he was an old bishop and he was retired, but he was very much involved in, you know, where he could be involved in trying to bring back the rebels, you know, back with the government and all sorts of stuff like that. So there's always going to be plenty to do, but just a matter of physically and emotionally, you know, what can you do as you're getting older and as your bones start to creak and your knees give out, as somebody said, when you're back goes out more than you do, then you really sort of have to think twice about what your contribution is.
Brian Gore, you're going to be around for a lot longer yet. Strength of character and strength of physique.
Don't get onto that one. I'll have to get to see my personal trainer when I get back to the Philippines.
It's been great to have you with us on Sunday night. Let's finish with Andrea Bocelli and Sarah Brightman, and it's time to say goodbye.
Say goodbye. Yeah,
Brian Gore, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Yeah.